Why is British English so much more sophisticated than American English?
Why is American English so much less snobby than British English?
Why would you call it an eggplant when aubergine is so much more elegant?
Why on earth would you call a cookie a biscuit if it's not twice baked?
Let's answer all those questions and more in another Transatlantic Words Unraveled.
Welcome to another episode of Words Unraveled. I'm Jess Zafaris, author of etymology books, including Words from Hell and Once Upon a Word, and creator of Useless Etymology.
And I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words. And today we're talking about the differences between British and American English. And you might have already noticed a difference at the start of this video slash podcast, and that is in the accents of the hosts. Jess, explain where you are and how that's affected how you speak.
I'm in the US. Specifically, I live in Connecticut, but I've lived in Chicago. I've lived in Colorado. I'm married to someone from LA, and I grew up, spent 18 years in Tennessee. So I have a lot of influence shaping my diction and the words that I use every day. But I know that I also can't speak for everyone in the US because the range of dialects, even in specific cities, is vast.
And across what I would say is a smaller area, the variation in dialects in Britain is also very broad. And that's where I'm from. And I've lived in different parts of it, only in England, I have to say. I've lived in London now, I've lived in Manchester, I've lived in Yorkshire, but I'm from a place called Derby, which is smack bang in the middle. It's the furthest bit of Britain from the sea, I believe. And I speak British English. I don't speak received pronunciation. I have a slight northernness in the way I speak. I don't say, please pass the basket, I want to collect some raspberries. I say, please pass the basket, I want to collect some raspberries. And so we get to the nub of what this episode is all about. And that is not necessarily the differences within our countries, but between them. Two nations separated by a common language is how George Bernard Shaw supposedly described England specifically and the United States. And it's true, isn't it? We do speak different versions of English, but they are different versions. They're not different languages, right?
Indeed, we've got a transatlantic war of words on our hands here. I'm very excited about it.
I think the most obvious way in which the difference between British and American English manifests itself is in, you know, the vocab that we use. People will have noticed, for example, that I would call a thing in a block of flats that takes you up to the top floor a lift. You would describe that whole situation very differently.
Indeed, that's an elevator. In fact, I would not use the word flat at all. I would use the word apartment, which do you know why an apartment is called a flat where you are?
No, I have no idea.
It's from Old English. It's flet was the, or at least F-L-E-T-T was the word for a dwelling, specifically like a ground floor dwelling, but it's meant to imply via its Proto-Indo-European root an area that's spread out that you live in. Personally, I think apartment makes more sense because it literally means a place apart where you can go and live.
But isn't anywhere that you live a place apart that you can go and live? Isn't that just a home, isn't it?
Well, ideally, but you could also have apartments within homes. You could also have segments and rooms within your house. Flat, on the other hand, seems very obscure to me.
We're going to try and keep this civil, but you're not going to persuade me that apartment is a better way. However many letters that is, it's so many I can't even count. Flat, neat, four letters, beautiful. Lift as well versus elevator. I mean, why would you want to waste your time with, what, one, two, three, four syllables versus a nice, swift one?
You know, I do like lift a little bit better, but I'll stick with elevator for the dialectical purposes.
Tell us about some more of these terminological differences.
What do you call a potato that has been deep fried and cut into a long shape?
Are you talking about delicious, delicious chips?
I am talking about delicious, delicious French fries. This is a fun one. Apparently, they are from around the same time, like within the same 3 years, which I think is super interesting. What Americans would call French fries, but what you call chips is first found in A Tale of Two Cities, interestingly enough. French fried potatoes is slightly earlier, 1856. And this is because at the time, cooking potatoes by immersing them in fat was considered a peculiarity of French cooking, whereas most English-speaking places would dry fry them in an oven.
What you've already debunked for me there is that story about how American troops around about sort of the First World War, pick any war, who were actually in Belgium, heard people speaking French and serving these potatoes served in this specific fried and long, and they called them French fries, just they're French because they assumed they were French, but actually they were dealing with Belgians. By the way, to me, a chip is thicker than a fry. We do differentiate between the two. Like what you get in a McDonald's, we wouldn't call them. I can imagine my dad calling them chips.
What would you call them?
It's a French fry. It's you know, it's distinctly different to what I get from a fish and chip shop.
For a thicker piece, I would call that a wedge, a potato wedge.
Oh yeah, but that's got to be to me that there's you know a geometrical
difference. There's a difference. Mm-hmm. We've got like steak fries, waffle fries. We've got tater tots. We've got every shape of fried potato and they all have but they usually all come down to like the umbrella term fries. I did notice since 1769 thin slices of food, specifically vegetables, but any vegetable and not specifically fried, were also called chips. So that one is a little bit older if you consider it on that front. But if you're just talking about fried potatoes, that's the 1800s.
So people watching this might be thinking, well, what does any of this matter, this difference between the words for chips and fries and crisps, which is what British people call potato chips. But I have a real world situation in which, to me, it did matter. To a 10-year-old me, it really mattered. Because I was sitting around a pool in Orlando, Florida, hungry, so very hungry. And what I wanted was just a small plate of chips, please. I'd love a plate of chips, some nicely fried potatoes, hot with ketchup. So I went up to the booth, to the man, and I said, can I have some chips, please? And then he went over to the back of his little booth where he'd got on the wall or into a basket or something to grab some
crisps.
Potato chips, right? Some crisps, indeed. And so I thought, oh no, I'm going to get the wrong thing here. So I said, and I thought, oh, okay, I know it's something else. It's not actually called that in America, is it? What is it? Potato, please. And so what he then got me was potato chips. So I still ended up with a bag of cold crisps.
Oh, that's unfortunate. One of my favorite, least favorite features of American English is periodically nationalism will get in the way of the word or the term French fries. So like in the near the outset of the Iraq War, when France disagreed with the U.S. approach to that situation, we tried freedom fries for a little while. And it seems to come in waves. Like in the 1950s, there was also a wave of American fries. And those were more of the like McDonald's styled ones for a little while. But French fries always comes back.
We'll definitely get into the impact of nationalism on American English in particular a little bit later in this podcast.
Oh, yes. The whole war on language has impacted food terms from a variety of countries.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, but also just the very existence of American English in its current form and its current written form has a lot to do with politics. Like I say, we'll get there later. Let's talk about a few more of the differences. And actually, you know, I talked about my chips and crisps trauma. There are a few other differences that can provide an awkward situation.
Such as?
Yes. Do you know why I didn't rush in with my own examples there? Because I know it's going to make me blush. And people have been leaving comments about the fact that I blush every time we mention anything rude.
That's my favorite part, though.
No, I'm doing it now. I'm actually doing it. Your watch is going to see. I'm blushing because I know we're about to start talking about fannies, and that's another word that would have made my grandma fall off her chair if she heard me saying it. But the word fanny is not as funny to you as it is to me.
It's a different part for me as it is for you. For me, it's a word for your backside, where for you, it's specifically my front side, so to speak.
Yeah, it's not mine. It's not every time I use the word, I'm not referring specifically to Jess. I should point this out. It can be anyone's. And again, I'm blushing even more than I normally am at this point. Moving on, we also have a problem with pants. Don't we?
Wait. No, hang on. My favorite part of the word fanny is where it comes from, though. Oh, have you? Do you know where it comes from?
Etymology podcast. Go on. No.
I'm gonna make you sit through this one. It's from the book Fanny Hill, or it's most likely. It may have come from a different source before that. That may have been the more salacious, like double entendre term. But the novel Fanny Hill, or Memoirs of a Woman of Pleasure, was a 1748 novel that touched off some landmark debates that resulted in legislation about obscenity and indecency in fiction. It was considered one of the first works of like literary pornography in English, and its author, John Cleland, was arrested in 1749, along with his publishers and printer, for corrupting the king's subjects. And I highly recommend that our listeners and viewers go and look up this novel, because it's in the public domain. You can find it on Gutenberg.org or archive.org. It is hilariously raunchy. I highly recommend it. It's very funny and involves lots of like heaving bosoms and twining loins, and it's delightful.
Fanny Hill is... And a person's name or a place?
It is a person's name.
Good to know. And lucky Fanny Hill for getting two parts of the body named after her.
Now let's talk about the clothing, the other awkward thing that that covers that part in question.
Both of them.
Generally speaking, when I say the word pants, I'm not talking about underwear. I'm talking about trousers.
Yes, you are correct. You're correct to say trousers, but if I were to be referring to pants, I'd be referring to what I've got underneath my trousers.
You could really put your foot in your mouth, so to speak, with this one. For me, trousers is more specific. Like, we do use that word. It's more of like, it's a designation that we use for like business wear. When I think of trousers, a trouser is a nice pair of business pants for any gender. But if I'm talking about underwear, it's underwear, it's panties, it's thongs, it's more specific. It's very exciting.
Yeah, we prefer not to talk about the unmentionables.
Do you know the origin of the word pants?
No, it must be from French pantalon somehow.
Mm-hmm. But originally, pantalone, are from the name of a character from Italian commedia dell'arte. Pantalone was a character who typically wore red hose or leggings, and all pants and panties and such are named after him. He was a silly, avaricious old man who tended to get in humorous entanglements with women and servants who openly mocked him. So I don't know that his pants are that critical to his character development, but they were a feature of this character trope anytime he would appear on stage.
There you go. Another thing related to pants, suspenders. You know that there's a difference in what that means between British and American English?
What does suspenders mean in British English?
Suspenders are what hold up your socks.
Okay, yes. So a garter is what holds up your socks for me, and suspenders are what holds up your pants. But you also have another word for the one that holds up your pants, correct?
We call them braces.
That's right. Which sounds like something to help you with an injury to me.
Well, yeah, it could do. But it comes in handy. We sometimes refer to, if something's come in a pair, we might refer to it as a brace. Hmm. As in two
like
things.
Like a brace of hairs, too. Mm-hmm. Okay, I've got one. If you're in.
Go on. Of course I'm in.
Okay. You probably have, my understanding is you have two different words for this, and I want to know the distinction here. What do you call like a baked, sweet, disc-shaped treat?
Are you talking about a biscuit?
I am perhaps talking about a biscuit, but nothing that I would call a biscuit.
Right. Yeah. Because is a biscuit stateside, is that a savory thing?
It is. It depends on where you live. But in all of the places that I lived, or most of them, a biscuit is closer to what you would call a scone or a scone. I don't recall which version of that pronunciation it is.
That's another podcast in its own right. Let's not get into it.
But it's a little butterier and a little fluffier. The ones that like that I make, the Southern style biscuits and gravy dish, is like a big buttery, fluffy piece of bread that kind of crumbles, and it doesn't require yeast or rising.
Right, but a biscuit in gravy in Britain would be an abomination. They should only go in tea. But the American word for what I would call a biscuit in most circumstances is a cookie, right?
That's right. And I've heard some British people tell me that a softer biscuit may be called a cookie even where you are. Is that correct?
Yes, those soft biscuits, yes, very much. They do get called cookies. And if it's got chocolate chips in it, it usually qualifies as a cookie. Can I use this as a jumping off point to talk about why there are different terms either side of the Atlantic for so many things? Because cookie's a good example. Cookie comes from Dutch, right? But it doesn't enter English in Britain, not from the Dutch just across the channel. It enters it in America from the Dutch, who are also with the English and the Scots-Irish and the Welsh, etc., who have settled over in America. And there are a load of Dutch terms that we've got that entered English in the United States. For example, cruller and coleslaw. I have no idea what a cruller is. Absolutely none.
It's a variety of like baked donut good.
Yeah. And it's similar, the word pretzel, right, which we get from German, but comes from German into English in the United States. And it's because of the cultural exchanges that are happening, all these people sort of living together. And one of the big reasons why American English is different to British English in terms of vocabulary is this mixing of immigrants, or with this shared story of either trying to escape Europe for whatever reason, or just to start anew. And so you also have Italian words that get used more in America, or that enter English in America, like zucchini. A difference. We don't call it a zucchini in England. What's a zucchini?
A zucchini is a long green squash. They also come in yellow, but you don't call them zucchinis if they're yellow.
Okay. We're talking about courgettes here, aren't we?
Yes, that is correct.
Took me a while to get there with that one.
Mm-hmm. But there's another one in the same family of foods, right? Again, I'm going to embarrass myself if I try to get too far into the plant world. But what I call an eggplant is not what you call an eggplant.
No, I call it an aubergine, mm-hmm. which is actually neatly takes me onto one of the other reasons why there are differences between British English and American English. Because, you know, America is built on enterprise, right? This is people who've taken the initiative to travel and they're having to spread out, whereas the Brits kind of sort of just resting on their laurels and doing their usual thing. But also, you know, the people who are in America, they're encountering different things as well. And they're having to come up with names for things. And they're doing generally one of three things. They're taking a Native American name for a thing. They see a skunk and end up calling it a skunk. They see a raccoon and end up calling it a raccoon. You know, Native American derived words. They take a word that some other Europeans are already using for a thing, like a prairie or a bayou or a levee. You know, we don't have those in Britain, so we don't have native words for them. Or they are inventing new words, but using English. And eggplant is one of those.
And eggplants are inspired by the small white eggplants that actually look like eggs, but the large purple ones are in the same family and flavor and everything as well.
Yeah, if you've never seen an eggplant where the actual plant looks like an egg, Google it immediately. It's going to really blow your mind. Did me. I only realized it very recently. But bullfrog's another good example of that, of, you know, taking some existing English words and putting them together to name something, you know, in this sort of spirit of ingenuity.
By the way, you mentioned raccoon. I love the etymology of that one. The Native American word it comes from literally means he scratches with the hands, which is a nice bit of serendipity with other words for raccoons around the world. In most languages, it means something like wash bear, which also references the fact that they use their hands to wash their food in water.
Yeah, I'm here in Germany and it is waschbier. It is wash bear. And by the way, it might surprise you to know we do have them in Berlin. I was out running the other day and a raccoon crossed my path.
Are they the same color as, they're like gray with the ringtail?
Yeah, they're an invasive species. They're the same guys.
Little jerks. I love them. Dear trash pandas. And speaking of trash, we should talk about this. I polled my my Twitter followers about this too, because I wanted to make sure there weren't too many regional differences, because it does vary a little bit. Garbage and trash are the words that I use, and they have specific instances, but you use two other words for waste materials.
Yeah. So we talk about rubbish. That's the stuff that you put in your bin and that the bin man comes to take away. And we have litter as well, which we use. I think that you do have that in American English, but we use it a lot more. Litter is generally stuff that, you know, is littering the street, but you can also have a litter bin, you know, stuff you, you put stuff in. You wouldn't talk about a litter bin, right? You'd talk about a garbage can or something.
No, litter is only when it's on the ground and had been discarded improperly. Garbage or trash is when it's, well, it can be anywhere, but the trash bag, the garbage truck tends to be what I use. One distinction that I was talking with one of my followers about is you would use a garbage person as the municipal worker who comes and gets your garbage, but you would not call them a trash person because a trash person means something else.
It's not terribly nice, is it? Well, while we're talking about sort of municipal services, here's an interesting one. So what you call the mail, I call the post.
Post.
Right. Mm-hmm. But my post is delivered by the Royal Mail and yours is delivered by the US Postal Service.
Mm-hmm. And we drop it off at the post office.
Oh, you do? You call it a post office as well. Mm-hmm. There you go. But you put it in a mailbox, whereas we put it in a post box.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And we have phone boxes and you have phone booths, right?
These days, not many. But yes, we do have phone booths. Sometimes we have the same pronunciation of a word, but we spell it differently. So let's talk about that a little bit. One of the most iconic or obvious differences that comes up the most, I think, is the fact that you spell words like color, armor, humor, honor, and flavor with a U, and there is no U in the ending of those words for me.
Yeah, that's right. And that is almost solely down to one man, isn't it? This is Noah Webster in his American Dictionary, where he very deliberately tried to, with consultation of other linguists, he wouldn't do it on his own, including Thomas Jefferson. He was a great believer in a new America establishing its own version of the English language. And he changed all kinds of spellings. Yeah, and the color was one of them. But to say that it's wrong would obviously be nonsense because
it just looks very French to me. It seems like vestigial U's on French words like couleur and other words like that.
Well, weirdly, by taking away the U, American English has inadvertently come closer to the Latin origin of the word.
Absolutely. And that also happens with endings like I's, I-Z-E, and Y-Z-E versus Y-S-E or Y-Z-E, like analyze versus analyze and paralyze versus paralyze or apologize. We spell those differently.
Yeah, I've got a list here of differences. And I'm just having a read through them here. And yeah, obviously the I's ones are a big one in there. I've also got a lot of double letters that in American English you don't bother with. For example, if I were to write down traveler, I would put two L's in there. I would put two G's in wagon.
You put two G's in wagon?
Two G's in wagon. I used to drink in a pub in York called The Wagon and Horses and it got two G's on.
Huh, no kidding. But also like in the name of this podcast, which we determined should have two L's in Unraveled because I actually prefer the double L on traveled and traveler and unraveled and raveled because to me it would look like it should take a long E if it's a single L.
Yeah, you don't want to be talking about Travilas and Wagons.
Right. Gets a little mucked up. But the U, can I get back to that for one thing? Because it seems like it's a little arbitrary. Like terror is from the French terreur, which has the U, and British English used to have the U, but it doesn't anymore. And I wonder if maybe like the Reign of Terror maybe put English speakers off from the Frenchified version.
No one's pretending that English spelling is consistent. We know the problems with English spelling, particularly when it comes to vowels. I'm sure we'll talk much more about the great vowel shift and the fact that the spellings of certain vowel sounds got fixed at different points during the vowel shift, meaning that they reflected pronunciations that didn't match. But also there were loads of different spellings for these French words. You know, you could spell color C-O-O-L-O-R at one point.
Of course.
You could spell it C-O-L-U-R. You could spell it with just about any constellation of vowels you liked, and eventually we ended up settling one, and we've gone for one rule with the word color but a different one for the word terror.
The US has the O-R-U ending on at least one word, and that's glamour, and my guess is due to the association with like French fashion, but in the 1700s it was spelled G-L-A-M-E-R, so that has also been through a change.
There are quite a lot of examples where there are differences between how British English and American English approaches French words. There's a lot of that. For example, and there's no consistency, by the way, in who tries to stay closer to the Frenchiness, the French pronunciation. To me, it seems like in America, people are more likely to pronounce what I would say as niche and clique as niche and click.
This is interesting because I ran into this on TikTok a little bit. These days, I have found more English, American English speakers using niche instead of niche. When I was growing up, I heard niche more often, but apparently it's gone through a bit of a wave, whereas click has always been click as far as I've seen it.
You know, I can just about put up with click. You know, I think of plaque and other words like that end with the Q-U-E, and you don't, yeah, fine. I mean, it kind of fits in with those. I don't know why, but it just does. But niche is to completely ignore the existence of that E at the end seems, yeah, that does seem like an abomination to me.
It does. It does. I'm not huge on that one. I myself have mostly started saying niche because I found that you get corrected more often if you try to say niche. So we're coming around on that one.
And do you think, oh, well, maybe there's something in like British, the class system, and us occasionally trying to sound a little fancier by applying French pronunciations. But here's an interesting one. Valet versus valet.
Yeah, that is interesting. I say valet.
Yeah, and in Britain and in British high society, you would say valet. And oh, and one more thing. We've talked about pants, but should we talk about lingerie, which is not pronounced like that in England?
How is it pronounced?
I had to look this one up. Right, because I thought it seemed weird. And I actually watched a video of a British woman saying, and this is how we pronounce this, lingerie, which is way, way closer to the French pronunciation. I mean, lingerie is way off.
It has an IE on the end, so you would think that E would make more sense. So that makes sense, but I don't know that I'm ever going to shake that out of my vocabulary. One of my favorite examples of British-American pettiness is the spelling of the word jail, which your spelling is nonsense. It is nonsense. I declare it nonsense.
We don't really use G-A-O-L anymore. And I've definitely never written it G-A-O-L in my line of work as a journalist.
That's good to know. But neither of them have much of a claim to like spelling superiority here because it's originally from the late Latin caviola, which means little cage. And it's just all kinds of nonsense all over the place. The OED says that the legal style guides basically justify G-A-O-L due to like official tradition.
Oh, okay. So they're basically officially just sticking by their guns.
Right.
You know what? There is a pervading idea, I think, in Britain that a lot of Americanisms are sort of modern innovations that have been made up to deliberately depart from the British way of speaking and such a, you know, are a diversion from the great tradition of the English language. And so we shouldn't be using words like oftentimes when we have the word often and we also have the word sometimes. But oftentimes is a good example of the point I'm trying to make here. A lot of the time, or indeed oftentimes, you'll find that these newfangled, and I'm doing quote marks with my fingers here, these newfangled Americanisms are actually as old or if not older than the term that's being used in Britain. Oftentimes, by the way, yeah, perfectly legit. Unfortunately, I was one of those who thought it was one of these accidental portmanteau, but it turns out it's not. Oftentimes has been said many, many a time. Oftentimes has been used. But also things like diaper, which is a much older usage for what we in England would call a nappy. You know, mm-hmm. what you clad your baby's ass with. What did I say? It's the coarse way.
I love it. Please keep it. Oh, it's perfect.
Yeah, well, diaper's an older word. Also, there's also a myth about the American preference for tidbit over titbit.
Titbit?
We say titbit. In
That's
England,
hilarious.
Right?
I guess it's like a titmouse is also a very small bird. Same idea.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, look how red I am. Anyway, but the myth in Britain is that Americans don't like to say titbit because of the sort of Puritanism
there,
which makes sense when you think about the origins of why people went over there. It's because they felt that, you know, England was, well, Europe indeed, was religiously going to pot. And so they needed to get over there and not use such horrible terms as titbit. But anyway, no, tidbit's been around for exactly as long as titbit. And to say that it's, you know, newfangled and an abomination against the English language is nonsense. Ditto off of, ditto gotten. You know, both of these things that British English speakers will avoid using because they write them off as Americanisms. You know, they're really not. They've been around for a very, very long time.
There are also Americanisms that are kind of like intentionally swaggery and I think a reactive way to like what is perceived as kind of a hoity-toity or snobby take on English that you see in like British English. And one of my favorite examples of this is, and this was invented sort of cross-pollinated by both British and American writers, but it was meant to sort of poke fun at the way Americans speak, or maybe to swaggeringly boast about the way Americans speak. And the words that belong in the category as the word discombobulate, which this is this category of verbs that were coined in the late 18th and early 19th centuries by playwrights often who were making a game out of compiling word elements like Latin sounding words and then nonsense elements like the bobule in the middle of discombobulate to make these sort of funny, entertaining words that were often put in the mouths of American characters, like all American Davy Crockett types. There are different variations, like absquatulate means to leave abruptly or run away, and it adds like the ab prefix meaning off or away from to squat, meaning like sit or stay. So you're literally running away. Another one is bloviate, which combines blow and orate. Another one is obfuscate, which is an intentional overcomplication of obfuscate. So we're doing a little swaggery American wordplay. Flustrate is a combination of fluster and frustrate. And scrumplicate means to eat and is similarly a play on scrumptious.
But it is fair to say that there is a very deliberate attempt in a nascent United States of America to create a different language and to use different words to a being used in Britain. Here I want to bring in a quote from Noah Webster, right, the writer of the first American English Dictionary, because this is a heck of a burn from Noah Webster. He says, "As an independent nation, our honor requires us to have a system of our own in language as well as government. Great Britain, whose children we are, should no longer be our standard, for the taste of her writers is already corrupted and her language on the decline."
Oh, boy. That's,
ow!
Goodness gracious.
That's our language.
There were phrases along those lines from like Teddy Roosevelt back in the day, too. Though he was a little inconsistent with some of that attitude, because there's one quote from him during the period when there was sort of a backlash to using foreign languages, especially like German during the early 1900s. Teddy said, "America is a nation, not a polyglot boarding house. There can be but one loyalty to the stars and stripes and one nationality, the American, and therefore only one language." Here's the irony, the English language.
But the Brits did kind of give as good as they got in terms of slighting this new sort of American approach to life, not just the language, but Samuel Johnson, who obviously wrote the most influential early English dictionary of the English language. He said, he's quoted as saying of Americans, "Sir, they are a race of convicts and ought to be thankful for anything we allow them short of hanging."
Ouch. Vicious.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's harsh, isn't it? It's harsh. He's not talking specifically about the language, but it does show the enmity that did exist and did drive American English away from British English to at least some extent.
Mm-hmm. I mean, American English has also provided plenty of words that both of us use these days too, as well, because it's, you know, we've been around for a few hundred years, but but like, you know, the word billionaire, things like that. Gubernatorial comes up a lot. Oddball, dugout, hideout. A lot of American English words tend to seem like they came from the movies, like crime films, or they're just related to sugar. So to hustle or be a hustler, to have like classified documents is an American take on that word. Swindling, gouging someone in terms of like taking, in terms of swindling them. Then words like cruller, like you mentioned, and cupcake and diner as a word for a restaurant rather than a person who dines.
Yeah, and also the turning of nouns into verbs. For example, we can thank American English for to interview someone, to divorce someone, or to vacation somewhere. We sometimes say to holiday somewhere in British English, but it sounds, ugh, we don't like it. Anyway, hey, here's a surprising one, a surprising Americanism that we take completely for granted in British English now. Teenager.
Oh, yeah.
Teenager mm-hmm. was seen as a horrible American import. I was looking at a style guide for the Guardian newspaper, the Manchester Guardian, as it was known, back in 1950. And it lists Americanisms to be avoided. One of them is teenager. Mm-hmm. Another one is to pinpoint. Another is the word balding.
Interesting. And, what's the alternative on that one?
They would want you to say going bald, right?
I mean, that is a noble Shakespearean tradition to verb nouns, so I take issue with that.
Yeah, exactly. But resistance to this sort of thing is always holding back an inevitable tide, right? It's always trying to prevent the kind of change that up until now, no one has ever managed to prevent with the English language. There's not just the words, but there's also the constructions as well that this style guide and that we've kind of resisted, but eventually have taken on board. For example, one of the ones listed here is saying aim to do something is out. You should have the aim of doing something. And it says you shouldn't help someone finish the job. Instead, you should help them to finish the job.
Yeah, to finish the job. We need the extra words, apparently.
Yeah. You need that infinitive form. You're using the wrong tenses here. Other ones that it rules out as well are to date instead of so far. That's seen as an Americanism. It does sound kind of corporate. It does sound a little bit weird even to me today. But anyway, all of these, right, are in this style guide from 1950. And I think you could probably find British people using every single one of these ways of speaking now.
We have so much more material to cover here between the two of us. I hope next time or in a future episode, we can dig into some of the phrases and terms that are more local to where we've lived, because I think that could be a lot of fun too.
Yeah, we have been so general so far, but really we should get into the dialects within Britain and within the United States. I want to tell you all about the myriad different ways you can refer to just a small amount of bread. I'll leave that one with you. I'm going to see how many I can come up with in the meantime. Thank you very much for watching or listening to another episode of Words Unraveled. It's been lovely to have you. Do leave your comments, leave your observations below the YouTube video, or you can email us on wordsunraveledpod@gmail.com.
We'll see you next time.